The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from today's edition, October 27, 2025 of Time Magazine. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. The front cover features a photo of a man standing near a body of water. Time, T-I-M-E, in large block capital lettering, is in white, superimposed upon a pale blue sky that juxtaposes with that blue-green body of water. The individual standing in front of it is male. He's wearing a light blue shirt, blue jeans. He has shortly cropped hair and some facial hair that is also nearly clean shaven. He's looking askance from the camera. I spent 491 days as a hostage of Hamas. This is my story by Eli Sharabi, and I shall turn to that article now. It's lengthy, so I may be abridging it. The end credit indicates it's adapted from Hostage, available now from HarperCollins. Again, this is by Eli Sharabi. It's within the World heading, the story I lived to tell. For Israel's hostages, as for the world, October 7 was only the beginning, by Eli Sharabi. Eli Sharabi's Hostage, the first memoir of captivity in Gaza in the aftermath of October 7, appeared in Israel in May, just 4 months after his release. The English translation was published in the U.S. on the second anniversary of the Hamas attack. A taut, immersive chronicle of endurance, the book also serves as a window into the Israeli view of the war. The author was pulled away from his wife and two daughters in the first hours of the attack. For the next 491 days, with rare exceptions, the only people Sharabi saw were other hostages and Hamas militants, the same parties that have remained front and center in the viewfinder of Jewish Israelis for two solid years, even as most of the world shifted its focus to the Palestinian civilians, also confined in Gaza and dying in the tens of thousands under Israeli fire. During captivity, Sharabi, that's S-H-A-R-A-B-I, ached for his life in Be'eri, which as a kibbutz or commune is the original expression of the interdependence on which Israel functions. Another is the army, which he looked for frantically and in vain, as he was thrown into a car along with a Thai farm worker. In the first of the excerpts below, they have just arrived in the strip. In the next, 51 days have passed. He's been hidden in a family's home, sometimes bound with rope in excruciating pain. Sharabi, who's terrified of being held in a tunnel, is being moved to one. He travels with a fellow Israeli hostage, one of several who will be his intermittent companions. In January, he's been moved again, this time to a space where he will remain for 8 months. Deliberately underfed, he loses a great deal of weight, but finds a different sustenance in traditions that bind even secular Israeli Jews. Sharabi also passes hours working to shore up the spirits of fellow prisoners and to glean something of what's happening outside from the mood of his jailers. Now, that is in italics, what I have just read. So it's a type of prologue. Now begins the memoir. October 2023. The vehicle stops. The terrorists pull me and the Thai worker out. The sun is beating down on me. I'm sweating. It was hot in the car. I had a heavy blanket over me and another person chucked on top of that the whole way. I'm also sweating from fear. The terrorists lead me out of the vehicle, still wrapped in the blanket. There's a huge commotion around us. I hear a noisy crowd, ecstatic, and suddenly hands start pulling me, many hands. I am being dragged into a sea of people who start thumping my head, screaming, trying to rip me limb from limb. They're fighting over me, cursing and whistling all around. My heart is pounding. My mouth is dry. I can barely breathe. I'm a goner. The Hamas terrorists try to push the mob back, and after a struggle, they pull me back into their own hands, drag me, and quickly smuggle me into a building. This is our first stop in the Gaza Strip. It is a mosque. I realize it because I can see the floor through my blindfold, which isn't too tight at this point, and I recognize the colorful prayer rugs. Having just managed to save us from getting lynched, the terrorists slam the doors behind us. Inside the mosque, it is quiet for a moment. I can hear my own breathing and the Thai workers sobbing next to me. The terrorists take us into a side room where they remove our blindfolds and order us to strip. I blink, look around, and see we're in what looks like a grand boardroom with a long table and luxurious chairs, like I've just stumbled into a board meeting at an American corporate office, not a mosque, in Gaza. With trembling hands, I remove my shirt and pants and strip down to my boxers in front of the terrorists' prying eyes. They start interrogating me. November 2023. We climb down a long ladder into the shaft. I am scared. Every nightmare, every fear, every fevered thought climbs down with me, step by step down the ladder. I brace myself in total darkness, for the Hamas tunnels I have seen on TV, the ones we have all heard about, and now it's me, going down into them. Any moment now, the trapdoor will shut above me, and I will be buried there. The anxiety is all-consuming. After 2 tense minutes of carefully climbing down, we reach the bottom, about 100 feet underground. It is pitch black. The terrorists have only headlamps to light the way. We walk a few steps, then descend a flight of stairs. A few more steps, another staircase. After the stairs, we keep moving forward, and I feel the ground sloping downward. We are going even deeper underground. We spend several stressful, silent minutes walking through a dark corridor with arched concrete walls. Then, at last, a faint white glow appears ahead. It is a fluorescent light, growing brighter as we approach. The corridor begins to widen, and we enter a space that has clearly been adapted for living. There is lighting, a real floor, ceramic tiles on the walls, a sink, a kitchen, a bathroom. They order us to sit on a mattress in the middle of this large room. It is hot, very hot. I assume it's from stress and fear. I take off my shirt, but I'm still hot. I take off my pants, too, and sit in my boxers. Almog sits beside me. We wait. I look around. The room we're in is long and narrow. At one end, there's a large TV mounted on the wall. At the other end, where we came from, is a wide opening that leads to the corridor. The corridor has other doors to the kitchen and a bathroom. There's another narrow corridor extending from the room, seemingly leading to another space. The terrorist we called the Triangle and the one who greeted us at the ladder, who we call Smiley, bring us water to drink and some wafers to eat. I do not feel like eating. I just keep drinking. I'm still boiling. I cannot believe I'm going to stay here, that I'm going to spend tonight here, and who knows how many more after that. I can barely breathe. We hear more people approaching. In the tunnels, we quickly learn, every sound carries, clear and sharp, from one end to the other. The sealed acoustics amplify everything. Amog hears it before me because my hearing has been a bit weak for years, and I guess the explosions have made it weaker still. Amog, and that's spelled A-L-M-O-G, hears the creak of the trap door opening. Hushed whispers, approaching footsteps. I hear them, too. Two young men are brought into the room and placed on the mattress across from us. We study them in silence. One is missing an arm. They glance around, disoriented. I wonder, are they hostages, too? Are they Israeli? After the captors leave again, one of them turns to us. You're Israelis, right? He asks. We nod. I'm Uri, and this is Hirsch, he says, pointing at the young man who's missing an arm. Who are you? I'm Amog. I'm Eli, I say. Where are you from? We were at the Nova Festival, says Uri. So was I, says Amog. They look at me. I'm from Kibbutz Be'eri, I say. January through September 2024. Difficult days lie ahead. This tunnel lacks basic equipment and supplies. It does not even have a landline for our captors, and they spend several days trying to set one up. Our only food is what they brought with them from the previous tunnel. In the kitchenette across from our cell, there's no gas, no way to cook the dry food. Like before, our captors sleep in the space next to ours. There's no corridor connecting the rooms, just a narrow opening at the edge of the wall. For the first 3 days in this tunnel, we eat nothing but biscuits. 2 or 3 in the morning, 2 or 3 at night. Biscuits and water, that's it. After 3 days, they bring us some raw ful beans. I start feeling weak. My body needs real food. I think it takes them nearly 2 weeks to get pitas into the tunnel. They're stale, probably foraged from the street. I don't care. I savor the single pita bread I'm given and devour it slowly. Besides the pitas, they give us a can of cream cheese. I break my pita into pieces, dip each one into the cheese, and chew slowly. I save the last morsel for the end of the day, just to fall asleep with something in my stomach. After 2 weeks of surviving on biscuits, one daily can of cheese between 4 men, and a handful of stale pitas, a gas burner finally arrives. We hope things will start to improve. They clearly have supply issues. That is clear soon enough. Unlike in the previous tunnel, there are no regular deliveries. All they have is what they manage to scavenge outside, and outside there's hardly anything. Hunger sets in, not from deliberate starvation, but from scarcity, for them too. Sure, they eat more than us and better, but even they don't have much. The shortages make them more irritable, less patient with us. We are careful not to cross them, not to speak out of line, not to make any requests. We're impatient, too. The hunger turns each man inward. Empathy dries up. These are hard moments when everything you are, everything I am, is reduced to one thing, hunger. Nothing else matters. Slowly our captors manage to sneak in more supplies. Because our room faces the kitchenette, we see them cooking and eating. They don't like that. We are too exposed to the contrast between their food and ours. They cook flat bread over the burner. Sometimes when they have sugar and oil, they make sweets for themselves. Right in front of us, the mask and smiley remain nice to us, even in these conditions. Sometimes they sneak us treats, halva, a scoop of sesame seeds, a small pita. But food is scarce. The stale pitas that arrive every few days give us a glimpse of the world above. The bakeries are not operating. There is no food coming in. Sometimes they manage to bring rice or pasta. They cook some and give us a little. We have no mattresses. At night, we spread our blankets on the ground and sleep on them in pain. Our toothpaste from the previous tunnel runs out after 3 weeks. We brush our teeth with plain brushes. After a few months, we get a new tube, but it only lasts a month, even after we agree to ration it and use toothpaste once every other day. There's no toilet paper. We clean up in the bathroom with a water bottle. There are jerrycans in the tunnel, some for drinking, hauled down by our captors, and others, not safe to drink, for washing and toilet use. We reuse the same water to wash our hands, clean ourselves off after using the toilet, and refill the water tank, since there is no running water. Our rations keep shrinking, and with them, the frequency of our bathroom visits. We do not share toilets with our captors. We have ours, they have theirs. They clean theirs, not ours. Soap is a rare commodity. When they have some, they give us a little. At first, more often, then much less, eventually not at all. Our hygiene deteriorates. Our bodies are filthy. We go for weeks without showering. Our clothes are never washed. Our space is never cleaned, and there's no way to clean it. Everything becomes gross. In the last tunnel, we got to shower twice in 40 days. Here, not even that. We shower once every 6 or 8 weeks with a bucket and a bit of soap. Every time we shower, we're shocked by how dirty our bodies are. The layers of grime. I scrub and I scrub with the little soap I have. I never knew the human body could collect so much filth. We constantly pray we won't get sick. We realize how easily it could happen. Diseases we had never worried about at home, infections that should not occur, could absolutely happen here. I'm spared most of them, thankfully, but not the others, or Alon and Aaliyah suffer from constant diarrhea, frequent vomiting, fungal infections, nails falling off. My problem is mostly dizziness. I think it's because I'm so weak. I'm skipping ahead now to November 2023 until release. In all the hard moments, the fights, hunger, humiliating searches, and conflicts between us, we try to create moments of strength, moments of togetherness. Many of our shared moments revolve around tradition and faith. I am not religious, but I am no stranger to Jewish tradition. I come from a traditional family. I spent many hours in my childhood in a synagogue on Shabbat and Jewish holidays. I made kiddush with Leanne and the girls every Friday night. And even though I lead a very secular life, and I am perfectly happy with that life, these traditional spaces give me strength. They give me fulfillment. Even in the early days of captivity, I find myself murmuring Shema Yisrael again and again, almost unconsciously, like a mantra to keep me grounded. Every morning, Aaliyah recites the traditional Jewish morning prayers out loud. He grew up religious and knows them by heart. He recites the prayers, and we stand and answer Amen. That's how we start every day. And every Friday night, we do Kiddush. No matter what we've been through during the week, what fights we did or did not have, whatever our frustration or sorrow or pains, we gather in silence, the four of us. We listen to Aaliyah, holding a cup of water in both hands, reading in a trembling, quiet voice, Yom HaShishi Vayachulu HaShemayim VeHaretz VeKol Setvam. The sixth day, and the heavens and the earth, and all that filled them, were complete. Before Kiddush, I sing Eshet Shail, a traditional hymn from Proverbs. She is good to him, never bad, all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax, and sets her hand to them with a will. I sing with my eyes closed, thinking about the women in my life, my mom, my sisters, Leanne, Noiah, and Yahel. Aaliyah does not know the song. I teach him the words every Friday, till he starts joining me and we sing together. Then we break the bread, or rather a slice of pita, we've saved especially for the Hamotzi blessing, like on Jewish holidays when we share memories with each other. Every Shabbat we tell stories. We each share what Shabbat was like at home, the foods we cooked or ate, the customs we observed. Saturday nights when the Jewish Sabbath ends, Aaliyah chants the Zemirot, the traditional table hymns. Sometimes we join him. Songs I remember my father singing, and that memory comes as a pinch of sweetness. I don't know if I feel God in those moments, but I feel power. I feel a connection to my people, to our tradition, to my identity. It connects me to my family, to my childhood, to my roots. It reminds me why I must survive, who I'm surviving for, what I'm surviving for. It brings back glowing memories of childhood, of my father, of my mother, of a white tallit during Shabbat prayers. Wine in a goblet, candles on the windowsill, opening the ark, Torah scrolls, a cantor singing, a white tablecloth spread over a table, overflowing with good food, everything that feels so far from here. And it brings to life the whole cast of characters waiting for me. Mom, my siblings, Leanne, the girls. I imagine returning to all of them. I imagine their hugs. I imagine the souls I love most enveloping me in light, whispering, Shabbat Shalom, Eli. Shabbat Shalom. It is so good to have you home. February 2025, I'm going to abridge this section. Saturday morning arrives. Our captors wake us up in the dark tunnel at 5, that's 0500, to start getting ready. We take our plastic bags and together with our captors begin the long ascent to the top. There are sections of this tunnel with very low ceilings, so low that you practically have to crawl. We get covered in mud. We keep walking and crawling through furrows of bare, cold, filthy earth, inching up toward ground level. It is a long ascent. The tunnel is extremely deep. When we finally reach the exit, we get given new, clean clothes for the release itself. Ugly brown suits, the perfect complement to our anyway disheveled look. We make our way through garbage dumps and junkyards until we reach a vehicle. The car windows are blacked out. Our eyes are blindfolded, our heads pinned down. The terrorists are not only afraid of the IDF, but also of the frenzied mob that would attack the car if it realized who is inside. The car stops. The terrorists remove us from the vehicle and remove our blindfolds. After a few minutes of standing around, the dress rehearsal begins. Hamas operatives give us stage directions for every moment of the ceremony, how to get out of the car, walk up to the stage, go up the stairs, what to say, what they will say, how to wave as instructed, when to smile, everything. It is a meticulously stage-managed spectacle. The team handling our release includes one Hamas member who speaks Hebrew. He's in charge of our media messaging and interviews. He sits down with us to coach us for the questions he will ask on stage. The questions are similar to those we were asked Thursday night for the movie shoot. Say this like that, he corrects us, and that like this. Emphasize this here, and that's there. He drills us again and again until he's satisfied with our answers and happy that they meet the needs of the production. We each have to answer 4 or 5 questions. I have only one goal, to do whatever it takes and give them whatever they want to ensure a smooth release, to survive, to get home. The previous article was abridged only slightly. The View, World, History Unended by Richard Stengel. Stengel's a former editor-in-chief of Time and served as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy under President Obama. In 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. The Cold War had ended, and it looked like liberal democracy had triumphed. That year, Francis Fukuyama published his famous essay, The End of History. which posited that with the fall of communism, an international consensus had been reached. No more communism or fascism, no more theocracy or monarchies, no more totalitarianism. Democracy had won. The phrase "the end of history" comes from Hegel, H-E-G-E-L, who prophesied that history would end when there was no longer ideological competition in world affairs. This was not the end of events happening, but the end of history as a struggle for the best way for human beings to govern themselves. After the fall of the wall, dozens of nations in Eastern Europe, Africa, Latin America, and Asia embraced constitutional democracy. There was, in Bernard Bailyn's wonderful phrase, a contagion of liberty. But something started to change around 2005. According to the Freedom House survey, 2005 was the last year when global movement toward democracy outnumbered declines. Every year since then, the number of countries moving away from democracy has outnumbered those becoming more democratic. Political scientist Larry Diamond calls this the democratic recession. We are still in it. The signs, weakening of the rule of law, the undermining of an independent judiciary, the diminishment of free speech, corrupt elections or no elections at all, and political parties that do not accept election results. Democracies do not die from the outside, but from within. They do not die at the end of a gun, but at the ballot box. They democratically elect leaders who then dismantle democracy. It is often unwitting. The people choose officials who seem strong, or who do not like immigrants, or who stoke their grievances, who say, "It's not your fault." My old boss, Barack Obama, loved to quote the Martin Luther King Jr. line that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. It is a beautiful sentence. The idea also arises from the notion that history is linear, directional, even providential. Of course you have to bend it yourself. But autocrats do not think that history bends toward justice. I'm not sure Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin even think there is a moral universe. They believe, like the ancient Greeks, that history is cyclical and that humankind is not advancing. That life, as Hobbes said, is nasty, brutish, and short. They seek to bend it in the opposite direction. What we are seeing now is a rise in soft fascism, a combination of ultranationalism, xenophobia, authoritarianism, and toxic nostalgia. The reason's clear: the immigration of brown people from the global south to the global north. The universal slogan, "Make Country X Great Again," is very often, "Make Country X White Again." Instead of moving forward, the wheel of history has turned back to the 19th century world of strongmen and power politics, spheres of interest, and economic nationalism. Conservatives in the U.S. mythologize the past and believe the benefits of immigration ended after World War I and the advantages of free trade ended after World War II. They have a 19th century mercantilist view of trade, that the U.S. must have surpluses with its trading partners and high walls to secure American sovereignty. 20 years ago, I was the head of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. I recruited Sandra Day O'Connor, the first female Supreme Court justice, for the board. Take it from me, she was a force. She's a member of the National Cowgirl Hall of Fame. You can look it up. One day she said to me, "Mr. Stengel, we're going to pay a terrible price for having stopped teaching civics in this country." We have. In one of the exhibition halls at the Constitution Center, carved into the marble wall, were lines from one of the most beautiful speeches ever given about democracy, "The Spirit of Liberty." delivered by Judge Learned Hand in Central Park in 1944 as World War II was raging. "I often wonder," he said, "whether we do not rest our hopes too much upon constitutions, upon laws, upon courts. These are false hopes. Believe me, these are false hopes. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women when it dies there. No constitution, no law, no court can do much to help. But that does not mean the situation's hopeless. Civics teaches us voting and protest are democratic superpowers. Let's get out there. Let's use them and continue to enlarge the circle of liberty." Richard Stengel wrote that, History Unended. And there is a photograph here, not quite a quarter of a page in size. It's in color, but it's mostly in gray and khaki. I'll read the caption first. "The wall that divided Berlin between communist East Germany and democratic West Germany coming down November 11, 1989. Okay, from this side of the wall, we see concrete, tall concrete, twice the height of the men standing between two fragments of it. They're standing upright. There's graffiti all over them in every color you can think of, black, white, blue, red, orange, peach, pink, green. Between the two upright sections of the wall, there is a man climbing on a narrow section as it comes down. He is climbing on it, perhaps to help crush it to the ground. There are people behind him, pushing him. These people are all in uniform. They're in khaki uniform, and I cannot see insignia on any uniform. I do not know from which side they come, but the wall is coming down." Here's a one-page article, The Risk Report, by Ian Bremmer, contributing editor. Argentina's president, Javier Milei, that's M-I-L-E-I, a man who's enjoyed extraordinary success with a move-fast-and-break-things approach to politics and economic policy, is starting to look a lot more vulnerable and at an inconvenient moment with the approach of the country's October 26 midterm elections, which, of course, have occurred, which could mark the beginning of the end for Milei and his reform efforts. With that said, I'm skipping to the end. Milei's party will also, of course, face greater opposition in Congress, further damaging the prospects of his agenda. Other political players, including governors and members of former President Mauricio Macri's allied Republican Proposal Party, will demand more concessions on reform and a much greater say in Milei's future policy choices, concessions he will be reluctant to concede. That was largely abridged because it's about Argentina's election. Here's the brief milestones. Died. There are two larger articles here, and 6 short ones. Died Jane Goodall, Ambassador of Hope, by Jeffrey Kluger. There are few people in human history whose last names alone are sufficient to conjure up a sense of kindness, goodness, wisdom, grace. Mandela, Gandhi, King, Lincoln. Add to that list Goodall, G-O-O-D-A-L-L. The other four left us years ago. Jane Goodall, primatologist, zoologist, conservationist, winner of the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire, DBE, joined them October 1, dying at age 91. Dr. Jane Goodall, DBE, UN Messenger for Peace, and founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, has passed away due to natural causes, the Jane Goodall Institute posted. Dr. Goodall's discoveries as an ethologist revolutionized science, and she was a tireless advocate for the protection and restoration of our natural world. The spare prose of the announcement was a fitting reflection of the quiet, deliberate way Goodall lived her remarkable life, qualities that were essential for work that required hours, months, and years crouched in the jungles and clearings of Africa, most notably in the Gombe National Park in Tanzania, observing chimpanzees from a sort of intimate distance and discovering their sometimes loving, sometimes violent, sometimes ingenious lives. Goodall had the gift of years and the gift of patience, and over the decades her discoveries spilled forth. In 1960, the year she first arrived in Gombe, she witnessed a group of chimpanzees eating a bush pig, disproving the previous belief that chimps were vegetarians. That same year, she made the startling observation that chimps strip the bark from twigs and use the denuded stick to fish for termites in rotting logs, overturning the jealously held belief that humans are the only animal to use tools. Chimps, she discovered, mirror humans in other, decidedly less benign ways. From 1974 to 1978, she observed what she dubbed the four-year war, an extended bloody conflict between two groups of rival chimpanzees in Gombe. That same year, she observed cannibalism among chimpanzees, when a mother and daughter pair stole, killed, and ate babies in their own community, likely to eliminate a line of rival females. But Goodall discovered a gentle side to chimpanzees, too. They play, they tickle, they kiss, they grieve. And in powerful moments of cross-species care, they sometimes accepted her, the quiet, comparatively hairless human observer, as part of their band. In 2009, Goodall spoke to Time about her years in the field and shared some of her most treasured exchanges with the chimps. In one such moment, she was following a young male through the jungle scrub, thrashing along and catching thorns in her hair as the chimp hurried ahead. Finally, she reached a clearing, a space across which the chimp could have easily hurried if he were trying to leave his pursuer behind. Instead, she found him sitting quietly, apparently waiting for her. Touched by the gesture, she found a palm nut on the ground, something chimps love, picked it up, and held it out to him. But the chimp was not hungry. He turned his face away, she recalled. So I put my hand closer, and he turned. He looked directly in my eyes. He reached out. He took the nut. He dropped it, but he very gently squeezed my hand, which is how chimpanzees reassure each other. That was a communication that, for us, predates words. On another occasion, she was observing a young mother she named Flo and her five-month-old baby who was just learning to walk. Flo trusts me so much that when he totters towards me and reaches out, she does not snatch him away like she used to, but she just keeps her hands protectively around him, and she lets him reach out to touch my nose. And this was just so magic. Flo was not alone in trusting Goodall. The billions of members of Goodall's own species did, too. We trusted her to be something of an ambassador between the human nation and the great ape nation. We trusted her to be an advocate for nature, and it was a trust that was rewarded. In her final article for Time in 2021, Goodall took up the cause not of fauna but flora, writing about the consequences the planet could suffer as millions of acres of trees are cut and burned every year. Forests and all plant life, she wrote, have a crucial role in balancing and maintaining the cycles of life on our planet. From space, Goodall wrote, our planet is a palette of white and blue and brown and green and the green is in retreat. But if everyone pitches in, she wrote of the need to support reforestation, we have a fighting chance to make a difference. Together, let's create a sustainable planet for generations to come. Let's give our planet a new reason for hope. In her near century of life, Goodall was all about the hope. In her final conversation with Time, also in 2021, she said, "I'm about to leave the world with all the mess," whereas young people have to grow up into it. If they succumb to the doom and gloom, that's the end. If you don't hope, you sink into apathy. Hope is a crucial way to get through this. Goodall's long, heartening campaign has ended. Let's now see if we're all worthy of her work. The second longer article is not so long. Selected, Sanai Takaichi, T-A-K-A-I-C-H-I, a first for Japan. This is by Chad DeGuzman. Sanae, that's S-A-N-A-E, Takaichi broke Japan's highest glass ceiling October 4 when she was chosen as the new leader of Japan's long-ruling Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, which holds just shy of a majority of legislative seats. The vote put her in line to become the first female prime minister of the country. Takaichi takes over from Shigeru Ishiba, who resigned in September after the LDP suffered historic election losses during his short tenure. Fueled in part by a series of political scandals in recent years that have marred the party's reputation and given rise to an insurgent far right in Japan. Takaichi is a hardline conservative, likened to the UK's Margaret Thatcher. Her victory marks a departure from Japan's male-dominated politics. The country ranked the lowest among G7 members in the World Economic Forum's 2025 Global Gender Gap Report, languishing in the political empowerment metric. Yet Takaichi's win does not necessarily portend a brighter future for Japanese women. Mikiko Ito, professor emerita on gender and politics at Hosei University, previously told Time that Takaichi behaves like men. Critics say that although she has promised more women in leadership roles, Takaichi has a record of backing conservative domestic policies and is expected to follow her mentor, the late conservative Shinzo Abe, in promoting traditional female roles in Japanese society. "You tend to appreciate the symbolic effect," Hiroko Takeda, a Nagoya University professor, says. "There is some superficial impact by having a female leader, but the essence there is an Abe-type LDP politics, which is very conservative, particularly in terms of culture and tradition." Okay, now here are the six thumbnail sketch reports. Killed, two people in an attack at a synagogue in Manchester, UK, October 2, Yom Kippur. The suspect and possibly one of the victims was killed by police, who termed the attack a terrorist incident. Sentenced, Sean Diddy Combs, October 3, to more than 4 years in prison after he was convicted of transportation to engage in prostitution. Installed, Bari Weiss, the Free Press CEO who has made a name opposing what she frames as progressive groupthink, as editor-in-chief of CBS News, October 6. Reappointed, Sebastian Lecornu as France's Prime Minister, October 10, just 4 days following his resignation, and just 30 days after his original appointment. Won the Nobel Peace Prize by Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, October 10. Named, Sarah Mulally, Mullally, as Archbishop of Canterbury Designate, October 3, making her the first woman chosen to lead the Church of England, beginning in January. 2 years of War is the title of this caption. The photograph is by Omar Al-Khattah, AFP Getty Images. This is the light box page. It's two pages. It's a double spread photo. It shows a crumbling building that's either stone or concrete. There are two spires on either side of the facade. There are tents in front of it. Oh, four or five tents. Some are white, some are beige, some are black. There are carpets hanging at the entrance of one of the tents. The sky is like icy blue-gray behind this crumbling structure. The caption reads, "A woman and child, yes, there are two individuals in the foreground, walk by the Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani Mosque at the Hamad City Residential Complex in northwestern Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, October 6. Nearly 2 years after the Israel-Hamas war began. Representatives from Israel and Hamas, meeting in Egypt October 8, agreed to the release of all remaining Israeli hostages in return for Palestinian prisoners and Israeli forces pulling back to an agreed line inside the Strip. U.S. President Donald Trump called it the first phase of our peace plan. The brief health, five symptoms foot doctors say you should never ignore, by Angela Haupt. If you want to take a step toward better health, see a foot doctor. You might learn something about a totally different and seemingly unrelated part of your body. Sometimes your feet are the first place where you can see warning signs of things like diabetes or vascular disease or even skin cancer, says Hira Mirza, a podiatrist at CLS Health in Houston. If you look closely enough, it really is a window to the rest of your health. We asked experts about the foot-related symptoms you should never ignore and what some of these issues can reveal about your health. One, hair that stops growing on your toes. When Ann Sharkey examines patients' feet, she always checks the hair on their toes, prompting a quizzical reaction. They're like, "Why are you looking at my hair?" And I tell them, "Because it stops. If it stops growing, we have a problem," says Sharkey, a podiatrist in Cedar Park, Texas. It could indicate vascular insufficiency, which means the body's veins are not working properly, leading to poor blood flow back to the heart. "I tell my patients that skin is like grass," she says. "Skin needs blood to grow, grass needs water to grow, and if we're not getting enough blood down there, we're not going to grow hair." Two, sudden pain in your big toe. If you wake up at night with severe toe pain, it could be a sign of gout, which Sharkey is seeing more and more in her office. The telltale symptom, a big, red, hot, swollen big toe that's extremely tender and painful. "You do not even want a bed sheet to touch it," she says. Patients call the office frantic in the morning, like, "I didn't do anything and I woke up in the middle of the night and I have this excruciating pain in my foot." They often show up to their appointment barefoot, she adds, unable to withstand the sensation of anything touching their foot. Gout is diagnosed through a physical exam and lab tests, and patients need steroids or oral anti-inflammatories to get their pain under control, in addition to ongoing medication management and dietary changes. Three, numbness or tingling in the feet. Sharkey's patients sometimes show up with symptoms that indicate metabolic problems like numbness, tingling, or burning in their feet that gets worse at night. "During the day, our body is processing so much external feedback," she says. "At night, when things are quiet, all of a sudden your body is so much more aware. What your body might be saying, 'My toes are tingling,' or 'They feel like they're on fire,'" Sharkey says. While people in this situation could be experiencing any type of neuropathy, the most common is related to diabetes, Sharkey adds, which is often a surprise to the patient. 4. A dark streak under your toenail. Mirza, the podiatrist in Houston, recently diagnosed a patient with subungual melanoma, a rare type of skin cancer that develops under the nail bed. The telltale sign is a dark vertical line that can also lead to other color changes in or around the nail. Get in the habit of doing regular self-checks, she urges. If you typically wear nail polish, which would conceal any discoloration, check your toes before applying a new coat. Subungual melanoma is curable when it's detected in an early stage. While treatment depends on the stage of the cancer, it might include removing the nail or amputating the toe in some cases. The goal is to not have to remove the entire toe, but it depends how soon you catch it, Mirza says. 5. An inability to bear weight on an injured foot. If you twist your ankle playing pickleball or wearing high heels, you might assume you can walk the injury off and you'll be back to normal soon. That might not be true. But podiatrist Damien Russo's patients often ask him what counts as a concerning amount of pain and swelling, and how to know if they should make a doctor appointment. I generally tell them that if you're still not able to put weight on the foot 3 to 4 days after the injury, it needs to be seen, he says. That indicates a more significant injury than they probably anticipated, such as a fracture or dislocation. From the View Inbox In the Loop by Andrew R. Chow, technology correspondent. In late September, OpenAI released its latest AI video generation model, Sora, S-O-R-A, 2, the number, advertising it as a big leap forward for the space. As Sora hits the public, it will have to compete for market share in a crowded field, including with a major competitor that is rapidly gaining steam, the Chinese company ByteDance, that's one word, B-Y-T-E-D-A-N-C-E, which owns TikTok. In the past few months, ByteDance released SeeDance, S-E-E-D-A-N-C-E, an AI video generator that users have called the best in the world, and a new version of SeeDream, S-E-E-D-R-E-A-M, an elite image model. ByteDance's advancements are a prime example of how Chinese AI companies are quickly catching up to American ones, despite chip export controls. Because their models are high quality and also cheaper, they are winning over consumers around the world, including in the U.S. But while they enthrall many users, these models also come with a host of concerns that plague many of the cutting-edge options. They allow anyone to create affordable deep fakes that are indistinguishable from reality, and also to freely reproduce copyrighted material. As these hyper-realistic AI tools spread, threats of misinformation loom large. Catherine Trendacosta, a director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, argues education is key to mitigating deep fake risks. We have reached this weird point where simultaneously anything can be generated, but no one believes anything anymore, she says. But we never solve the underlying problem. We just keep targeting the new technology, and not media literacy or teaching analytical skills or how to evaluate sources. Health Matters by Alice Park, senior correspondent. This will be abbreviated. Gene therapy is becoming a powerful way to treat challenging diseases that do not respond to traditional treatments. And researchers now report the first success in modifying genes to slow Huntington's disease. In a study reported by Uniqure, which developed the experimental gene therapy, scientists found it slowed progression of Huntington's disease by 75% over 3 years. The study has not yet been published in a scientific journal. 17 people who received a high dose in trials showed a 75% slowing in the progression of their symptoms overall, compared with a group of about 2,000 untreated Huntington's patients, matched to the study patients by factors like age and disease stage. All who received the gene therapy were monitored for several years. Uniqure, that's Uniqure, plans to submit a request for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to grant accelerated approval of the gene therapy to treat Huntington's in the first part of next year. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.